Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the first James Mead Memorial Lecture. As you know, James Mead was one of the greatest economists of his generation, and he, more than anybody in Britain since Maynard Keynes, influenced how we think about economic issues. He was also, for those of us who knew him, a most wonderful person and a wonderful father. And it's a great pleasure that we have the whole Mead clan here, including James's wife, Margaret. And I think we'd like to say how grateful we are that they could come. Now, I don't want to say, I can't say too much to describe James's work, but I would like to mention 3 points. Which will help to explain why we have our current lecturer. First, there's his extraordinary contribution in the Second World War when he was a civil servant and wrote the first draft of the Full Employment White Paper, which was a guideline for post-war policy in Britain, and the first draft of the GATT, which was the international guideline for the trading system, which led to the economic miracle of the post-war period. Then second, there was a period at LSE from 47 to 57. James Mead loved the school. I think his family would concur in that. And he did most of the pioneering work in international trade here, for which he got the Nobel Prize. And then finally, there's his work as the founder, I think one could say, of the systematic study of public economics, based on a concern for equity as well as efficiency, but taking into consideration all the constraints that flesh is heir to. And James really was motivated throughout his work by the belief that by rational thought you could make better choices and improve the world. And that's the link between him and Jim Merlies. And when we thought about who could give the first lecture, Jim was the obvious person. Since James retired, Jim has been the intellectual leader of the British economics profession. He has pioneered systematic study of many areas in public economics, such as the design of tax systems, and he's taken the whole field into new territory by his approaches to uncertainty, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize. But the similarity between him and James Mead is remarkable, as I said, in their whole motivation and drive to use economics to improve the world. So it's wonderful that Jim was able to come and give this lecture. He will take questions afterwards, and the topic he's going to talk to us about is economic welfare and nations. Jim Merlies.
I regard it as a very great privilege to be giving the first lecture in memory of James Mead. He was the clear example that there were giants in these days, and he has been, for me, a constant inspiration. He was amazingly systematic. The amount of economics that he covered, illuminated, contributed to, unbelievable. A shelf full of books that he wrote, full of splendid stuff. It's hard to think of anyone comparable, really. And for me, it happens that he's been a constant inspiration, not only because of the way that he applied himself always systematically to all kinds of things and really quite a practical way, but I suppose above all because he was a utopian, and I regard that as rather a good thing. And he was always prepared to think of things utopian. This lecture is going to be, I suppose, even more utopian than anything that James usually ventured. I have for a long time been interested in, as it were, geographical economics, and I strongly approve of the view that has become stronger and stronger that somehow geography and international economics are the same kind of thing, a view that's been put very strongly by Paul Krugman and many others, and is gradually changing the view of international economics. I'm not an international economist, so this was the closest that I thought I could properly come to territory that, that James Mead would have been interested in. Let me just put up one slide, which very briefly gives you a flavor of what I'm going to do. Title changed a little bit as I typed it in. The echoes, I suppose, are fairly clear, and I want to range in this direction, and we'll see how far I get. So that is your range of topics, and I'll try to explain as I go along what I'm after. For the economist, of course, nations are governments. But we have to recognize that there are governments at many levels, in fact, and the nation is one particular level of government that somehow is the most powerful or most controlling level of government. So I'm going to get to that in due course, but you can see from the list of brief topics that I just put up that I want to start at a sort of mini-nation level, a level where there aren't very many current nations at all, and then I will gradually get there. But what I want to talk about during the lecture is essentially issues of economic judgment. Economic policy, yes, that's what James Mead was above all interested in, always. So I'm very interested in economic policy as well. So I want to pick out some thoughts of economic policy, but clearly as we go on and get beyond the nation to look at things internationally, it's going to be harder to say anything very satisfactory about policy. Like James Mead, I have always been more interested in finding methods for recommending policies than trying to explain what policies are actually adopted. But I do think that in this whole territory that I'm going to be talking about, there are indeed a number of conundrums about why policies are adopted that we have and why others are not. Another thing that I've been influenced very much by James Mead on is methods of evaluating economic policy. I tend definitely to a utilitarian view of these matters, but what I'm going to talk about this evening is in areas where taking that view can be particularly unpersuasive or difficult. And I want to draw out some of the conclusions that one might have if one takes a utilitarian view, but will recognize that these aren't entirely convincing. So I want to start by talking about the local economy, and the local economy, I'm going to ignore farming and agriculture and so on, important though it is, so I'll take the local economy to be the town. Now you can see straight away that the flavor of all this is that I'm thinking of an economy where economies of scale are quite important, and therefore, in fact, production gets concentrated in part, perhaps in very great part, in towns and in cities. And this is, of course, the particular emphasis that has become very important in geographical and international economics. So I want to start by just reflecting on and revising the issue of what an economic town should look like. A town, as economists have come to use it, I don't know quite where the idea of this first came from, would be defined by producing just one thing. So that's the particular, rather artificial definition I want to use. Of course, the reason then why a town exists at all, if it's producing only one thing, is that there are economies of scale in producing that one thing. Otherwise, production would be distributed right across the landscape, the way it is in agriculture. So a town is a concentration where this one thing is made. It might be a carpet factory, it might be for food processing. What should such a town look like? This doesn't really seem to conform very well to the standard economic models, because of economies of scale not being allowed in the standard economic models. And that means in the standard economic models you don't have towns. Well, there are two features that come up straight away from this. One is that somehow or other the scale of production does get determined in the town. There is some particular level of production that gets made, and it's pretty obvious straight away that there's going to be a limit to how much production is going to be done, because towns can't get too large. The main reason why towns can't get too large is that there isn't room for everybody in the world, or everybody producing a particular entity, to cluster round one particular factory. So even if there are economies of scale available without limit in the production of things like, say, motor cars or whatever, you do not expect that there will just be one factory in the world that produces motor cars. Instead, there will be towns. You will think straight away, however, that it's very hard to think of any town in which only one thing is produced. And of course, I agree, we have to start with simplifications, and I take this as the simplest starting point. And first, we have to think out what is the right way to organize a town, and whether the way that it will get organized by a market economy is the way you'd like to see it. There are two elements to this, I said. One was the scale of production. That's a serious issue. And the other is how people are going to be distributed in the town. Because towns actually take space. They're not just points. And people live around the producing point. Now, if you think of a single producer, you may feel this is really not a tremendously important feature of towns, that some people live a long way away and some people live absolutely next door to production. But it does introduce a very interesting feature in the nature of a town, which is that people are necessarily unequal. Even if, of course this is false, but even if everybody were the same, even if everybody was going to do the same kind of job in the factory, some people are going to live closer and some are going to live further away. Nobody needs persuaded that the optimal organization of a town should not be equality, because equality would, of course, mean that people were distributed in a ring a long way away from the center, and that makes no sense at all. So some people are going to be lucky enough to live close to the center, and some are going to live further away. And some people are going to occupy quite a lot of space, and other people aren't going to occupy so much. And you would expect that in a town, you would get that kind of inequality even if everybody started the same. People do not all start the same. Some are more skilled than others. Some will have higher incomes than others as a consequence. The high-income people might live near the center in penthouses, flats, not have a lot of space, but not spend a lot of time in traveling. The lower-wage people might live further away. What we actually observe in the world is that people have different tastes, and they spread themselves out in different dimensions. But the only point I want to make about this is that because of the inequality amongst people that arises simply from geographical necessity, a utilitarian would have to think that there was a case for redistributing amongst people who all start the same, that you actually have an argument for creating a kind of randomness in the income distribution that wouldn't be there initially. And even if there is a lot of inequality amongst people, it could still be desirable, and a pure utilitarian view, to create this random element in the distribution of income. Now, no country has done that, to my knowledge. I doubt very much whether people will be readily persuaded by it. But I wanted to introduce that as a first digression, because it tells you some of the problems that arise from thinking about economic policy from a purely utilitarian standpoint. But what I'm actually interested in is the other aspect of what the scale of production should be. Now, you can't really properly ask the question, how much should be produced in the town, how big should the town be, unless you have somewhere in your theorizing a concept of a government arranging things appropriately, that's to say, redistributing income in whatever is the right way of doing it. So I'm going to take that for granted in the background and report what seems to be the case here. That if the firm in each town chooses how many people to employ in a profit-maximizing way, you will indeed get the welfare optimum. That sounds like a very basic and simple economic proposition, one that everybody learns right at the beginning of an economic course. But the context in which I'm describing it is not at all the context in which you get it in the simple economic course, because here you have economies of scale. So I've got to explain how it could possibly make sense to have profit maximization here. But I think that's pretty clear when you think about it. The firm has to decide how much to produce. The more it produces, the more people it will need to employ. The more people it employs, the bigger the town will get. The higher will be the rent of land. People will have to, on average, live further away from their work. They will therefore have to travel further into work, or they alternatively may have less space to live in. In all of these ways, the higher cost of land, the greater distance to work, people would be worse off if they were paid the same wage. If people are to be attracted to work in the town, and if they would enjoy some wage elsewhere, then they're going to have to be paid more. Consequently, as employment increases, as the scale of production goes up, as the number of people, therefore, in the town increases, the wage that they have to be paid goes up. And that's why it can make sense to talk about a profit-maximizing firm. That even although, as it employs more and more people, and of course uses more capital and so on as well, it is able to produce more per unit of input, because the cost of the inputs is going up, predominantly the cost of labor, you nevertheless get an equilibrium where the firm decides it is not worth going to a yet larger scale of production. Of course, this is a theoretical account, highly simplified account of what might happen. But it's a case then of every firm having a local, in the jargon, monopsony. Each firm has its own labor force. It has its own town. There are many towns in the economy. We've come to the nation now because, of course, this is all against the background where there are many towns. And in each town, if there's equilibrium, the producer is supposed to have chosen the scale to balance off, on the one hand, the advantages of extra scale of production against the costs that extra scale of production creates. And what are these costs? They're essentially transport costs. I know they're tied up a bit with things like occupying space too, but this is all consequential on the fact of transportation costs and of people occupying space. Of course, if people didn't occupy space, transport costs would not arise, so there has to be some element of occupancy of space for this whole argument to work. I've described the equilibrium, but of course I haven't given you an argument that says that this somehow creates the best of all possible worlds, which is what we need if we're going to be maximizing economic welfare. Well, actually, the argument is not at all difficult, but I decided I wouldn't put up pictures and show you how things go. It's really the same sort of argument that works in the standard case where you don't have any economies of scale. And it all has to do with saying that the extra output that you get has got to pay not only for the people who are working, but for the extra costs that are created by the extra transport costs. It's a way of capturing the trade-off between scale on the one hand, or concentration, or the advantages of the division of labour, and the costs of transportation on the other. This argument doesn't go through quite as nicely and neatly if you introduce transport costs into the transfer of goods around the place. And of course, transport costs in goods and commodities, quite important, as well as the transport costs of people. But I think, at any rate, we have there an interesting basic principle from which I want to start that suggests that in the world where economies of scale matter, that, quote, the market, by which here, obviously, we mean the independent activity of individual economic agents, may indeed bring about the best of all possible worlds. But this, of course, you remember, is the start of the story and not the end of the story. And we're not going to find, as we go on towards the nation and beyond, that the same morals hold. How do we have to go on from here? Well, we certainly have to take a different view of the world as soon as we recognize that there must be some reasons why in production entities, in cities, I will now call them, many kinds of production take place. I don't really need to rehearse the many obvious reasons why that should be true. The fact that transport costs are indeed important in goods, that most producers use all kinds of inputs, and many of the inputs they use will have to be made locally. That there are many services that consumers will desire which would be expensive or impossible to consume at a distance. People will want doctors and teachers and people to serve in shops. So all kinds of production are actually going to occur in these economic entities that we call towns or cities. And therefore, the picture as I've described it so far will be inadequate. And the question is what happens when we consider this more general model. I'm going to sketch one aspect of all of this, which I think is potentially quite important. Just let's imagine, for the reasons I've indicated, that we're dealing now with, I call it a city, in which there are many kinds of production being done. It's the same sort of situation that I was just describing. But these many producers are each of them employing many people. Again, in order to keep this story clear and simple, I will just talk about producers using workers. I will not comment explicitly on the many other inputs that they may use and the role of capital, for example, or land for that matter, none of which really make any serious difference to the argument that I'm alluding to. But now you see, instead of having a single producer, we have many. So each producer, going through the calculation that I indicated of whether it's worth expanding the scale of production, considering the extra cost that there will be because of having to pay higher and higher wages, the greater the scale of production, has apparently a rather different set of considerations. Or rather, it's the same set of considerations for each individual producer, But the consequences for the utopian who is looking at all of this and saying, do I think it's working out well, are very different. At any rate, if we accept that the model as I'm describing it has some degree of realism. Because when you employ more workers for your firm, and therefore on average make it necessary for people to have greater transport costs in getting to work, you have the same consequence for other workers as well, workers in other firms. So, roughly speaking, there is an externality, an external diseconomy that each employer would seem to be imposing on the other employers in the city. The whole argument can get very much more complicated than I've indicated, and I'm overstating things by putting it this simply. But put that simply, you see the consequence is that every firm in the city will expand excessively, and the scale of production adopted by each of them will be too great, because each firm, in expanding its scale, has given too little weight to the costs that are imposed on the people in the town, which are indeed true costs by expanding employment. Now that's the theoretical story. The consequence would be that cities are too large. And you can see that if your typical city has many producers and the model as I've described it were correct, that cities would tend to be much too large, not just a little too large, because you'd have many producers and the main costs from expanding employment would fall, most of the costs of expanding employment would fall on the other producers and not on each individual one. Now, naturally, I have some serious doubts about the realism of this account. It's clear that the argument goes rather too far, but it is suggesting that cities in the world will be too large if the account as I've given it is correct. There is indeed a difficulty about this as to why firms would indeed choose all to produce in one place. It's still true, as far as my argument's gone, or as far as the model I've described applies, that in this world, producers should each of them prefer to set up a separate and independent town. But of course, the reason they don't must be some, for example, because of the convenience of transportation between the different firms, and that my argument did not properly take into account. There's been a lot of discussion as to why production localizes. Now, localization in the literature refers to something more specific than anything I've said so far. I haven't specifically said that I imagined a city in which the producers were all making different things, but that's probably what the picture suggested to you. You think that the reason for having many different producers is because you need a whole variety of things to be produced in the city, and therefore there must be many producers. And that's fair enough. But since Marshall, and perhaps before, people have been very interested in another very curious phenomenon, which is localization of production, where the same thing gets made by many producers in a particular city. Paul Krugman has described many instances of this. Famous example would be Akron in Ohio, where most of the rubber production in the world, or certainly in the United States, was done at one time, although no longer. And of course, Silicon Valley in California is supposed to be an example of the same kind of thing, although production there is so distributed over a wide area that it hardly conforms to the sort of picture that I've given you of the city, whereby implication the producers are all operating close together. Of course, the reason for taking this extreme example of the model of pretending that production takes place in a rather concentrated part of the city, known to urban economists as the central business district, is, of course, because many cities do indeed have central business districts, not necessarily one, but a number of remarkably concentrated places. And as I say, you even get this extreme phenomenon of having many independent firms producing the same commodity, like knives and forks in Sheffield or whatever it might be, all in the one place. And according to the argument I mentioned, this is not a good way for things to happen. Why is there this localization of production? It seems to be generally agreed amongst economists that the reasons for this have to do with things like the advantage of having an experienced and knowledgeable labor force, of being able to get the right kinds of skills readily, and the way in which when a new firm is set up in a particular line of production, it is going to want to get a hold of people who are good in its own particular field and therefore sets up close to others who are doing the same. I'm not sure that that exactly explains why universities have lots of different departments all in one town or in one place, which doesn't seem to conform exactly to that argument, but I remind you, we see this phenomenon in very many ways. I suppose that one should be explained by the perhaps more popular idea that somehow, and this goes back to Marshall, knowledge floats from firm to firm, and there's a lot to be gained by being close to others who are doing similar kinds of things to yourself. So I would not wish to deny that there are gains of that kind, and these are indeed externalities which are unlikely to be properly internalized by the individual producers and might to some extent offset the considerations that I've been talking about. But I suppose that I think that on the whole, cities tend to be too large, and they tend to be too large for exactly the reasons that I've been indicating. That should bring us to the question of economic policy. What would economic policy be like if it were to tackle this problem, if indeed it is a problem, of cities getting too large? Of course, exotation might be one of the things that non-economists would think of. I was interested to hear this morning that there is a report out today, mainly, I think, by meteorologists, on the future problems arising from the greenhouse effect in this country and the like, where they happen also to speak of the great problems of having so many people in the south of England. Actually, the way that the BBC talked about it made it sound as though part of the problem of land disappearing under the sea was there'd be so many people in the south of England that it would gradually sink. And I know that as people sit on the M25 watching it, they sometimes suspect that that may indeed be true. But I do think it's true there are lots of people. What policy would be sensible? The obvious one for an economist is taxes, of course. And in this context, the usual principle would apply, a principle that James Mead would have applied for this sort of context, that you should apply the tax where the problem is. And the problem in this case was that employers are not supposed to see correctly the cost of employing people. So you must increase the cost of employing people. In other words, it would appear on that basis that you should have a tax on employment. And that seems quite believable. Of course, we do have taxes on employment. We have income taxes and things like that, so that they should have some of the effects that we desire. What this is saying is there is another argument for having a tax on labor in addition to those that are normally used. But there is another possibility, and this brings me a little closer to the issue of nations that I'm going to go on to next. It's a possibility that I don't find very attractive, but it's something that in some degree seems to me actually to be used, which is, of course, to restrict entry. there are city-states, there have been city-states, and city-states do sometimes restrict entry into them. I was recently in Hong Kong, and this is a matter of very serious consideration, economic policy, where, of course, there are many people in the other part of China who would like to emigrate to Hong Kong, and where currently they're not allowed to do so. And there is a serious legal issue as to quite how things should be, but it seems pretty clear that the outcome is going to be that they will not be allowed to emigrate to Hong Kong. And let me say parenthetically that all this strikes me as in other ways regrettable, even if it is, in a sense, a substitute for the kind of policy that I was describing previously, namely a tax on employment. That seems to me regrettable for a very different reason from the ones I've been talking about so far, and takes us on to the issue of nations and what they are and what they do. The specific point I have in mind here is that you'd think the great advantage of Hong Kong becoming part of China was that it raises new possibilities of economic policy for China. And the obvious one would be redistribution. This is the topic I want to come to now, because what nations make possible, amongst other things, is redistribution within the state. The example of Hong Kong is particularly striking and indeed troubling, because Hong Kong, as well known, is much, much richer per head than any region of China. And therefore, redistribution within the country, the double country, as it now is, of China, would have very dramatic effects, probably, in Hong Kong. Well, particularly since my Hong Kong friends seem to find the 15% maximum rate of income tax awfully disturbing. And an increase from 15% to something more reasonable would certainly prove to be more disturbing. Now, this reminds us, you see, that within any nation of any big size, there are going to be cities of many different sizes. The kind of economic theory I was sketching in terms of towns and cities has the disturbing property that it can rather suggest that you would get a lot of towns and cities of rather similar size. You'd have similar things being produced in different places. And of course, at some levels you might get that, but of course the world looks very different from that. You get a distribution of city sizes and town sizes, and even if there may be some sort of size that a city can't really grow beyond because it begins to take far too long for many people to get into work at all, nevertheless, cities keep getting bigger and you have a very big distribution. That upper limit is, I think, quite important in the world. The distribution of city sizes does not follow Zipf's law or the Pareto law at the top. There are many cities of rather similar size, the very largest ones. It's not true that the largest city is twice the size of the second largest city in the world. It would be very surprising if it was, and that must be, I think, some kind of evidence that there is something like an upper bound, a largest possible size to anything that could sensibly be called a city, rather than a collection of cities that happen to be close to one another, like the American Eastern Seaboard. But that's not the major source of inequality within countries. You do have towns and cities of many different sizes. Now, people think about inequality in countries and redistribution as a reasonable economic policy to deal with inequality. They don't usually think of this as primarily being inequality amongst towns or cities. The Hong Kong-China example is quite peculiar and unusual, and appears to arise from the two having been quite separate for a long time and for two nations having become one. However, you do get very substantial inequalities within nations, inequalities of income, but regional inequalities as well. And these may perhaps not be best described as inequalities amongst the different towns and cities within a nation, but it's part of what we observe if we compare northern and southern England, northern and southern Italy, northern and southern Spain. I should say for Spain, I suppose, more southern and the belt from Madrid to Barcelona. So you get considerable differences between them, and within countries, you automatically get redistribution between them as well. Because insofar as the tax system is redistributive and has people with higher incomes paying more and people with low incomes receiving subsidies, then of course there is some equalization going on between these economic entities. I'd remarked right at the beginning that for the economist, nations are governments. Problem there is that nations also seem really quite arbitrary. Why boundaries are where they are rather than some other place seems on the whole rather difficult to see. Geographers, of course, work on this kind of topic. Economists, being intellectually imperialist, may, I suppose, get onto this question as well and may come up with some reasons as to why nations take the shapes and forms they do. But as far as I can see, it's very difficult to answer. Particularly if you take this view that nations are, as I say, governments. Governments being things that spend as well as tax. Governments being things that spend on armaments and fight wars, as well as things that provide education and sometimes medical care and provide a redistributive tax system. So certainly the redistributive tax system is not the only, perhaps not even the major activity of a government at the national level. But it's at the national level, I suppose, that redistribution primarily takes place. Most of the other features could take place at the regional level within a country, though I suppose that would not be true of arms, since that's normally held as a monopoly by the central nation. What can we say about economic policy within a nation beyond the desirability of this redistribution? I think that's essentially the main point we want to make there, but I want to move on to the next level beyond, which is the level between nations, and ask what one could say about economic policy between nations. This is a topic of, in principle, great interest to international economists who have worked on questions like what's an optimal currency area, what's an optimal customs union, what are the consequences of creating a customs union. And similarly, one has the question, what is the point of an economic union? What would indeed be an optimal economic union? Now, it seems to me that that question would tend to a very different answer to the other questions that international economists have addressed. We know it's not an entirely irrelevant question because nations do, in varying degrees, enter into cooperation or enter into economic unions, and we are part of one. And it is one feature of the European Economic Union that it redistributes between nations. It's an interesting feature of it, and when I referred to puzzles about explaining economic policy, then I think this one is a bit of a puzzle as to why the redistribution within the economic union is between nations rather than between people. Of course, that's tied up very much with the question of tax harmonization. But tax harmonization was not a far as I can see, thought of as a move towards having a common tax system, redistributive tax system within the economic union, but a way of having similar tax rates in different countries so that various problems of discrimination between commodities would disappear. However, from the economic welfare point of view, from the point of view of economic policy, you might well think that this is a highly desirable way of proceeding, to think in terms of redistribution amongst people rather than amongst nations. It's true, of course, that redistribution amongst nations, and it doesn't happen in very large amounts, but it's significant, must have consequences for redistribution amongst people. If one country has to pay, like Germany, quite high taxes to the European Union, it will necessarily have to tax its inhabitants rather more highly than it otherwise would have. So you may say, well, redistribution among nations comes down to redistribution amongst people fairly much. But it seems to me that there are considerable differences and that it's unlikely to work nearly as well. This issue ties up also with the question of what would be an optimal economic union. Which countries would you wish to have united from the point of view of utopian economic policy? And I suppose it's evident there that you would wish to have unity amongst countries of very different income levels, of underdeveloped and developed. Indeed, at the time when it was a serious issue whether or not Britain should join what is now called the European Economic Union, one alternative held out was that we really should concentrate on the Commonwealth and that that would be a much more appropriate kind of economic union. Although, as far as I know, nobody contemplated having an extensive income redistribution within such an economic union. But granted that redistribution is something that has considerable welfare benefits, if you take the view that poor people have much higher marginal utility than rich, there seems an obvious argument for having cooperation amongst countries of very different income levels rather than rather similar ones. Now, the range of incomes within the European Union is fairly high, so that it's not automatically disqualified by these remarks, and indeed bringing some of the East European countries in is naturally going to get us closer to what one might think of as an optimal economic union. The consequence of considering this is that people discuss how to reduce the extent of transfers between the nations within the union rather than considering the advantages of increasing them. So we must be struck when we contemplate economic policy among and between nations how strong are the political forces towards not having very substantial transfers amongst nations, towards not having very much cooperation in economic policy. That is actually quite surprising, since even if you were to think that we must recognize this unwillingness to have a kind of overarching world welfare view of economic policy, that there are considerable interests in governments cooperating with one another on the elements of economic policy. This has often been commented on, but not apparently pursued very far. What I'm referring to here is the argument at the microeconomic level that countries should negotiate over the kinds of income tax rates they will have. Now, that's a theoretical argument that says each country will, in setting its income tax rates, have to take account of the effect these rates have on people's willingness to stay in this country rather than going to another. This applies both to labour income and to capital income. In setting tax rates, governments should, if rational, take account of this tendency for people to take their labour or capital somewhere else where it will be taxed less heavily. It's a constraint, or a rough, to put it in a rough and ready way, on the levels of taxation that it's appropriate to apply. Consequently, if similar countries that each have to consider this were to get together and discuss what their income tax rates should be, they should both increase them. At the upper end, I mean, of course, it becomes possible for them to agree, even though they're not redistributing from one to the other, to have a superior tax system, because they can take account of one another's welfare. In other words, we would do better to negotiate a Pareto efficient arrangement between the nations rather than put up with a Nash equilibrium, which is always going to be inferior. Not pursued. And why? I suppose that one reason for this could be the inequality amongst nations. Because one nation is much richer than others per capita, that the negotiation might not actually make a lot of sense. If the main consideration here is that people will go to America because there they will get much higher incomes, then and America is indeed a much higher income country than most of the others, then that's a much weaker argument than the same one that you might have between equal countries. The strength is much less. So I think that's one reason why countries are reluctant to get into this. But I am puzzled that countries don't do more to eliminate tax havens, that Britain, indeed, if anything, seems to have encouraged them over time. And that is very puzzling, and you would think would be a very clear case where one might do something about income escape as a problem in the construction of tax systems. But if we're speaking of transfers among nations, then I suppose the major issue really is the very simple, straightforward one of economic aid. And I wanted to reflect finally on what you might think would be the simplest of all economic policy recommendations one might make, very much at the utopian international level, that there should be transfers from rich countries to poor, and there should be famine relief, there should be something more. Now, there are several things to be said about that. It's not entirely uncontroversial that this should be done and that this would be effective. But the first thing I would observe is that it is done. That's to say, the principle of this seems to have been accepted by countries. Many of the rich countries have accepted as an aim that I believe it's 0.7%, not a large number, of the gross domestic product should be official development assistance. Some countries have exceeded that, and have exceeded that for a number of years. The Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands. Japan is getting close. Other countries that appear to be committed to this have got nowhere close. America has now succeeded in getting below 0.1%. of GDP, despite this commitment. And that does seem rather to go against simple utilitarian ideas of the desirability of redistribution, that the richest countries should actually be amongst the least generous in the transfers. What puzzles me is the implicit acceptance of the principle without any acceptance of a reasonable application of the principle. One could understand a country saying or thinking up reasons why somehow or other there wasn't a moral obligation to make transfers to poor countries. Or alternatively, there might be an argument that it would be very ineffective to do so, somehow bad for them. And of course, there may be some element of validity in that. But apparently, these things are not accepted because transfers are made. And yet the transfers are made at a very tiny level. And that seems to me, in a way, puzzling. Of course, it's probably to be thought of as an epsilon argument, that it's recognized that something is good, you can do it to some extent, but because it would not be politically acceptable to do very much, all you can do is epsilon, and different countries have a different size of epsilon, some tiny number that will be unnoticeable. Well, of course, I think that that is an immensely regrettable fact. Nobody nowadays, I suppose, speaks of world economic government in this context, although they may speak of world economic institutions in another macroeconomic and monetary context. But I would hope that one didn't lose sight of the possibility, this would be really utopian, of having a world redistributive system. It doesn't, of course, need to be immensely large. To what it, how large it should be, on welfare grounds, of course, much larger than any of us could bring ourselves to put up with. But it seems to me rather regrettable that economists have moved away from thinking hard about this issue of economic aid and its magnitude, although some here have indeed written on this subject. So I just finally remark that if it is true, as I certainly believe it is, that trade is, that aid is partially ineffective, that's to say that it is difficult to identify where it's to go, it's difficult to ensure that it goes there, that these things are arguments for reducing the amount of aid, but not for eliminating the level of aid. And if you try to put numbers to any argument like that, if you suppose that 50% of your aid goes amissing and trying to get it to where you want it to go, goes into the pockets of the government officials and so on, well, so it does. But nevertheless, the income differences in the world are so great that the case for making the transfers still remains very strong. It would be interesting to put together calculations of just how strong a case it is, and certainly in doing so, one has to allow for the very different effective price levels in different countries, which is implied by the sorts of things I've been saying about towns and cities and about the cost of living in a town and so on. One must allow for all of these things, but the case remains very strong, and I hope someday that more may be done. Thank you very much.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. An incredible number of really fascinating arguments, well in the utopian tradition which you described at the beginning. Who would like to ask the first question or make the first comment? Don't be shy. Well, perhaps I'll ask one question. You didn't refer to the arguments from the individual side for living in towns to eliminate the risk of living in big towns, to eliminate the risk of living in a smaller town which might be hit by some sort of misfortune. It seems to me that the argument from the point of view of the individuals for living in large towns is at least as large as whatever argument there might be from the employer side for having access to a pool of skilled labour. I think there's a tremendous number of reasons why people want to live in these big towns, which have kind of positive externality features to them. Or is that not right?
Oh, yes. of course, I think while people's tastes differ in this respect, people have very different tastes. Some of us don't like to live in big towns, and others do. But granted, there can be a very strong consideration there. We're really then asking about margins, that you should reach a point where it getting yet bigger is disadvantageous to people. And I think that's necessarily the case. The risk saving, well, that's intriguing, but this is thinking of being in a city as a way of diversifying your portfolio. And that could be true in a number of ways, like it may be easier to get another job if you lose one, things of that kind, as well as the range of you get a better chance of finding a good opera or a good play or all of this kind of thing, which I suppose is indeed a significant thing. I'd wondered in this context what the implications of what I suppose is more or less a technological fact, that long-distance transportation seems to be getting cheaper rather rapidly. Short-distance transportation doesn't seem to me to have been getting cheaper. Now, that may be in part because congestion has been going up just as fast as any technological developments have been occurring. But London taxis don't really look much different from what they did when I was wee. And the underground doesn't look as though it's changed much since my grandfather was wee. And on the other hand, it's got an awful lot cheaper to fly to Madrid or somewhere. And this, of course, suggests an entirely different change in the sort of pattern, the way people might live. People will talk about the business of working from home, for example, which is part of this, because changes in communication costs are analogous to changes in long-distance travel costs. And I believe that there are fairly rapid developments of that kind, which are actually going to mean that people will prefer to smaller places and then quickly and cheaply from time to time go to the big places. That seems to me much more like the pattern people would choose than being in the big place to reduce risk. Certainly have an effect. I mean, it's bound to have some effect on the possibilities of taxation, of course, which rather interests us. But it's not necessary to have your taxes much on commodities. You can have your tax on labour income. So I don't actually think that the problem of taxing consumption of music when you download your CD straight off the internet is a great problem. It's only a problem insofar as governments want to stick to taxation of commodities rather than taxation of labour. But I do think that people are going to operate much more remotely. And the intriguing... So perhaps I shouldn't go too far in this direction, since I think the possibility of living in the Isle of Man and effectively working in London is something that should be getting the Treasury a bit worried. Mind you, it should get the Isle of Man pretty worried too, if they have to have M25 congestion as a result. But an awful lot of work can clearly be done remotely if making goods amounts to pressing a switch. The switch can be a long way away. We think that a lot of things must necessarily involve people, and an awful lot of labor activity is in moving things around. I mean, that's what people are doing in supermarkets and in getting the goods to people's homes and things like that. So it's a little hard to see quite how we, as it were, get rid of the postman. He still seems to have to work in the main country. But that's why I think tax havens are a potentially very, very difficult problem for the kind of economic policy that I favour, which is redistributive.
I don't think the main reason that the present government is opposed to raising taxes is because of fears of immigration. And I wonder what you think the reason the Labour Party in this country is so much less enthusiastic about redistribution than it used to be.
You know, I agree that the migration is only one element, which I used as an illustration of a particular point. And I suppose that they actually think that the incentive issues are quite important, and that they also think that votes are quite important. So I said I wasn't going to talk about trying to explain economic policy. But you invite me to explain economic policy. And there does seem to be a belief that, so we say, a fat median voter, and you know, spread them out, is not keen on these high tax rates. This theory doesn't, of course, work terribly well, just because you'd think there can be no median voter problems about taxing high-income people like you at 80% on the margin. So they may be thinking incentives, but there's something else that goes on about the noise of politics, as it were, rather than the direct influence, and the thought that actually your marginal voter, your median voter, is probably quite strongly influenced by a sense of people complaining further up the income distribution, being disaffected. That's a guess.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the potential benefits to developing countries from trade as opposed to their benefits from aid being given to them from developed countries? And leading on from that, how do you feel that the WTO, what kind of things should the UK be saying to the WTO if it wants to make a practical improvement for developing countries?
Well, I suppose that it's pretty clear that reducing trade restrictions of whatever kind on imports from developing countries is a benefit to them, of course, absolutely right. And on top of that, of course, it may not be very bad for us, which is the argument, and it goes back to Adam Smith and beyond. I mean, it's sort of part of the economist's credo, isn't it, more or less, that there aren't many good reasons for taxing imports. And there are some theoretical arguments, but they don't look very, very strong arguments for most kinds of imports in practice. So it's hard to think of it as aid if it's actually beneficial to us to do that. Which I suppose then might say, well, should we have subsidies on imports from developing countries? Which is going a step beyond. That somehow it may be good to improve things that way. It's analogous to benefiting somebody in the country by subsidizing what they produce. So it's analogous to subsidizing employment, sale of labor by low-income households. It's not a bad way to proceed. I mean, one could say, yes, that's better on incentives than simply passing money over cold. So there may be something to be said for it, but I just think that nobody's going to adopt a policy of negative tariffs to benefit developing countries. One should get as far as one can by pushing for a reduction of tariffs. I notice, of course, these are not things that I know a great deal about, but apparently countries are always anxious to get something in return for their reductions in tariffs. It's a highly negotiated area, and apparently China doesn't get let into WTO without having to pay quite a lot for the privilege. Second point first. Okay, that's fair enough. I was taking, shall we say, a rather long-run view of thinking. It was surprising how many of the tax havens are essentially British. Cayman Islands, Isle of Man, Channel Islands, and so on. But that's on the margin, the move has been the direction that you describe. Yes.
Well, yes. So which country is it?
It's an overseas dependency. An independent country which chooses to have its foreign affairs defence by Britain. Do not legislate for taxation.
You mean they have their own passports? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they have their own parliaments.
Of course, the Isle of Man is its own parliament, but it's still part of Britain.
We don't encourage them. We're not embarrassed by them.
We allow them. And, Well, it just seems surprising that the number of these was about Britain. But on the first point, remind me, what was...
Why you get so close to the Pareto by governments forming a cartel?
Yep. So I'm interested in the next stage, I think. The simple answer is, of course, because governments are supposed to be good. In other words, it's only good governments of which this is true. And that makes them a little different from firms, perhaps. On the other hand, I was also giving some arguments why monopoly behavior may be desirable in a context where there's free entry and so it doesn't actually generate profits, which is the one of the optimal towns that I was talking about at the beginning. So even firms may sometimes be good.
Well, I think that's a good note on which to end the idealistic, benevolent government, which is certainly, I think, the way James Mead thought. You've carried on his tradition splendidly, and this has been a very, very interesting evening and absolutely the right tradition. I don't know whether the next James Mead lecturer will achieve the same thing. The next James Mead lecturer will be Gordon Brown. So we'll see whether he represents the benevolent government or the government aiming to be re-elected. The next James Mead lecture will be on the 8th of May, so please put it in your diaries, and let us thank Jim for a great evening. Thank you very much, Jim.